to the show, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Asher Brooks, and this is Horrible History with Asher Brooks. Joining me once again is special guest Kit Olson, who you'll recall from some other fantastic episodes we did, The Resurrection Men, and also a really great episode we did quite recently about Gustav the Kevlar Crocodile and the Bone Wars. Joining me also once again is Will Trudell, who is making his second appearance on the show, doing a fantastic job. He'll be listening along with us, talking with us as well. So, Kit, what have you brought for us today?
Well, first off, Asher, how bona tavada your dolly old eek.
I don't know what you just said.
Right? So that's what we're going to talk about.
Okay.
So
that was a good opener.
Yeah, there you go.
I was prepared for you to be better at this than me. Don't emasculate me.
It's too late.
It's too late. I'm going to turn this recording off. We're going to start again.
Right.
What did you say? So what's going on?
All right. So the phrase that I have just uttered to you is a traditional greeting in what might as well be known as a dead British language, akin to Latin for the Catholics.
Okay.
There is a very somewhat antiquated tradition and form of language known as Polari. Polari is a bit of an unusual sort of piece of Britain's history post-World War II.
Okay.
Initially, we'll turn back time just a little bit here. I know, Asher, Will, you guys are like big D&D nerds,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You both played Rogues before,
yes.
Right?
Yes, I love Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know that if you're playing D&D as a rogue, one of the very first things that you wind up learning is a little thing called Thieves' Cant.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. It's like a free language you get when you pick rogue.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a free language that you get when you pick a rogue. Now, Thieves' Cant itself is a time-honored tradition,
mm-hmm.
that has been utilized as far back as like the 16th century. Lots of petty criminals, thieves, murderers, anyone who was on the outskirts of society, would often learn different ways to talk to each other in order to skirt around the topic of what someone was saying. You know,
okay.
So let's say that, you know, you and I were planning to burgle a place.
Yes.
And we wanted to talk about how we were going to do it,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't want anyone else listening in or knowing necessarily what we were talking about.
Yeah, 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 okay.
So
it's like a secret code.
Pretty much. But oftentimes, the way that secret code would operate would be pretty obvious. Like, it would sound like we were having a conversation about something else entirely.
Okay, so it's not like we're talking in pig Latin.
Yeah, it's not like we're talking necessarily in full-on pig Latin or speaking another language. You and I could, to all accounts, be having a conversation about the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do it today, the sun's out.
Mm-hmm.
Could mean we're being watched.
Oh, okay.
You know, something right. like that, right?
Yeah, so it's all code and doublespeak and innuendos and things
exactly.
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of these secret languages were heavily based on, you know, context. And if you knew the code, it kind of meant that you were with the in crowd, right? So
yeah,
you,
yeah.
So you, if you knew these tiny little bits and pieces, congrats. Along that line, throughout like the 19th century, came another like new wave, basically, of the Thieves' Cant language, and it became known as Parliari.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now Parliari was used specifically by more like traveling entertainers, circus buskers, like. It was often frequently used by prostitutes as well as a way to, like, talk about, like...
talk about clients and Johns.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
A safe way to be like, hey, this guy looks shady, or, you
yeah,
know...
Yeah, he doesn't look cool, or, like, I need you to go get the bouncer for me, but I don't want to make him mad
exactly.
because he's in the room.
Exactly. So, you know, like, I know I've seen a couple of times people have tried to get something like the angel shot.
Yes.
Currently, like,
yes.
going.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, you ask the bartender for an angel shot, and it means, like, hey, help me get the fuck out of here.
Can you call somebody and pretend, like,
yeah.
this guy is being weird? I'd like it to stop.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, prostitutes would frequently use Parliari as
mm-hmm.
a way to do that. Similarly, it was a way for, like, carnival, the carnies.
For carnies to talk about, like, that guy's got money.
Exactly. Like,
let's
hey.
See if we can't get him to where we need to get him.
Precisely. But because so many of these groups traveled not just throughout the UK, but also throughout the rest of Europe, they wound up picking up a lot of different bits and pieces from French, from Spanish, from Italian. Polari itself has a lot of Italian, like, leaning words that aren't fully Italian at all.
They just kind of seem Italian?
Yeah, they seem vaguely Italian.
Okay.
But, you know, they wound up picking up tiny bits and pieces of, like, Yorkshire, like, rhyming slang was another thing. So, like, if I said plates, what would you think that would mean?
Plates?
Yeah, plates.
Plates. I mean, if it's rhyming slang, what does plates rhyme with? Plates rhyme with gates.
Yeah. So, plates is only half the phrase. It's plates of meat. Plates of meat. Mm-hmm. And, meat rhymes with feet. So it was, plates was a synonym for feet. Yeah. It's one of those really, like, again, it's like...
really esoteric.
Really esoteric. And to anyone else who's listening, it's like...
what are you saying?
What are you saying? I have no idea, right? As Parliari kind of began to develop and pick up these little bits and pieces of, like, the rhyming slang, you know, this was usually, like, East End London and, like, Cockney. They would pick up, like, little bits and pieces of Yiddish phrases. Like,
so it's getting some, it's getting some Jewish, some Hebrew in there.
Yep, yep. So, like, one word that we still use today, really commonly, zhuzh, to, like, fix up.
Yeah,
right?
Zhuzh something up.
Yep, to zhuzh something up, right? That was commonly used as, like, a phrase both in, like, Parliari and Polari.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons why it became more popular as like, an overall phrase.
Polari, like, so Polari is used by carnival barkers and prostitutes and all the fun people.
So basically what winds up happening, as Parliari begins to kind of mutate throughout the course of a couple of, you know, world wars that wind up happening.
Yeah, of course.
Another evolution begins to spring forward in the late 40s, early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, it is for those on the outskirts of society.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, it was still used, a la traditionally, by some of those with somewhat shadier dealings.
Mm-hmm.
But primarily, it was used by closeted gay men throughout the United Kingdom in the 1950s.
I gotcha.
So, in case you guys were not necessarily familiar... specifically, post-World War II, there was an extreme moral crackdown in the UK. They basically wound up being like, we can't ever allow ourselves to that level of degeneracy, sort of thing. So along that line, there were a lot of more heavily implemented, like, anti-sodomy laws, like, a lot of things that were meant to crack down on, like, homosexuality.
Yes, yes, because they're trying, after wars, things do tend to, like, governments tend to shift, because a lot of things are allowed during war.
Exactly.
Like, smuggling becomes a big problem during war, because people need their stuff.
Yep.
And so, when wars end, there's usually a tightening of rules and things like that. We'll actually get into this in my section of the story, but right after, so America didn't have a secret service, or an intelligence service until after World War II.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Because after World War II, they realized there were all these spies in America.
Yep.
And they're like, we've got to solve this problem right now.
Yeah.
So they're cracking down on all these homosexuals, and so they developed this language.
Yeah, pretty much. So basically, because of the very sudden, like that crackdown, basically, on specifically, like, sexual morality.
Yes.
Gay men wound up being, like, prosecuted to record levels.
Yeah.
And as well as, like, facing blackmail or, you know, violence from members of the public as well.
Yeah.
They also had, like, the threat of imprisonment, electroshock treatment. There were hormone treatments that were given in order to try to turn gay men straight, but often, like, just cause them to, like, grow breasts. Oh. Yeah.
That's so awful. That
backfired.
Yeah.
It backfired so bad. We want you to be straight, so we're going to give you tits.
Pretty much. But because being openly homosexual was really dangerous.
Yeah.
Parliari found new life in the form of Polari, which was a way to kind of cautiously out yourself and act as like a little bit of a gaydar. This is 1950s, 1960s gaydar, right?
I gotcha.
So if...
it's little dog whistles.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And if the other person could pick up what you were putting down, they might respond in kind.
I gotcha.
So, prime example, the way that I greeted you earlier today. How bona tavada your dolly old eek, right? What would you think bona means, knowing that Polari has...
Some Italian. Bona would be like, maybe... bona, I want to say, is like good, because I'm bueno.
Yep, there you go.
And like, you know, romance languages tend to be similar.
Yeah,
so I assume it's like, good morning...
Yeah.
Are you gay? I don't know, because now I'm just assuming it's all about, like, hey, man, are you gay? Can we chill?
Yeah, no. Specifically, yes, bona means good. So if you were, you know, if you wanted to, you know, if someone asked, oh, how are you? You could say, like, oh, bona, I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone caught the fact that you were, like, hey, you said bona, you might throw in a little Polari phrase yourself.
Okay.
Just to be like, hey, I know where you're coming from. I know what you're up.
I also know that language.
I also know this language. Let's talk, right?
Yeah, because you can't, I guess it would be really, you imagine you're like, you are this way, you are homosexual, because it's 2023, homosexuality is not a choice.
Yep.
And so, you know, you are gay. And you have no people you can connect with.
Yep.
But the only way to connect with these people is to reveal yourself.
Exactly.
And the only people you can reveal yourself to are people who you think might be gay and might be reciprocating your feelings. It's like, imagine like all the stress of high school.
Uh-huh.
Of like, hey, do you like me? But also if that person doesn't like you, go to prison.
You go to prison and you get electroshock. Yeah. Right? So like...
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
so there's,
damn.
Yeah, so you're, like, really riding this fine line of, like, how much can I say to you?
Mm-hmm.
How much are you going to understand?
Mm-hmm.
And how much can I trust you?
Yes.
Because there were also, on occasion, just really awful people who were themselves, like, homosexual.
Yeah.
But the police would sometimes, like... Would turn them into CIs,
confidential informants.
Exactly. So on occasion, like, you might have someone who knows this language, who knows Polari, but also might wind up like reporting you to the police. So there was a lot of like constantly evolving like slang.
It was always shifting. Yes.
Exactly. But the greeting I gave you before, bona tavada, your dolly old eek, it means, it's good to see your lovely face.
It's good to see your lovely face too.
Yeah. Eek is a bit of slang. It comes from, so face backwards is eekaf, and eek is like the abbreviation of that.
Yes. Yes. It's like Emma Neckaf is fake name backwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say, I love spies and codes and riddles and stuff.
Yeah.
I just love the idea, like, we're gonna speak entirely backwards, but we're gonna take one letter off. We're gonna move everything to one side.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk in absolute gibberish. And that's very cool. So, I mean, does it work? Do they stay safe?
So it winds up working for a decent amount of time.
Okay,
you know,
good.
It winds up being a way, you know, you're at the pub, you're on the tube, you're having a conversation with somebody out in the middle of a park, and just by dropping a few of those little words, it winds up revealing to that person that you maybe suspect is like the same sort of alignment that you are, you know, swings your way.
Mm-hmm.
If they respond in kind, that usually means, hey, you want to hook up? Yeah, let's hook up. It was basically Grindr.
Yeah, no. I mean,
it was like, imagine all of the text lingo that we have today.
1960s Grindr.
It's early 1960s Grindr.
Yes, great.
It good was like, them. Yeah, no, exactly.
Good for them. They gotta get their.
You know, it's good. It's important.
Absolutely. Did they continue using it until, like, you know, things relaxed, or?
So what winds up happening specifically, and this is also one of the things that wound up like really leading to kind of like an attitude shift. In the mid to late 1960s, right?
Yes.
There is a British radio show that comes out called Round the Horn, okay? Yeah. And you have in that show a pair of comedy characters. They are incredibly campy, screamingly gay. They're a pair of out-of-work actors named Julian and Sandy that live together. And this winds up becoming one of the most popular and award-winning radio shows in the UK. But what winds up being really fun about it is that you'll get, like, they would have these sorts of things that many people would see as being, like, oh, that's funny, it's a double entendre. And then the homosexuals listening would be like, that is a triple entendre, and that is dirty. Like,
it is a triple entendre. Put that cucumber down,
sir. Yeah, no. I have a wonderful example right here. And once again, content warning, because, you know, we're being a little blue here.
Oh, for sure. I slapped a content warning on this episode before it ever went out.
Good.
It's because you want to hear nasty, nasty words.
Yeah, so basically, the reason why they wound up doing this as well, these two characters would use a lot of Polari to sneak past the BBC censors.
Like, the funny daddies over there.
Yeah,
the BBC.
Exactly, right? They're just like, oh my god, all of these censors, they're ridiculous. So they would use Polari, because of course it was the gay slang at the time too.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, it was kind of like in vogue for the gay community.
Yeah.
And it wound up being like kind of a fun way to, you know, code them as being queer.
Yeah, because you couldn't openly say they were queer because prison.
Because prison. But you could definitely code them as being queer.
Yes, you could imply it.
You could heavily imply it. And by using the Polari as well, it meant that you were able to get, like, some extra fun little things in here.
Absolutely.
So, like, in one particular episode, Julian and Sandy wind up being hired on as domestic helps, basically.
Do they have to wear little maid outfits?
I have no idea.
Oh, it's a radio
show.
It's a radio show. I'm going to imagine the actors in maid outfits
from now on,
but that might just be for my own fun. My own edification.
Please do. So they wind up being, like, shown into a kitchen where they're supposed to, like, go to work, right? Julian complains, like, oh, I can't work in here. All the dishes are dirty. Ooh, speak for yourself, ducky, responds Sandy here. Now, this is a triple innuendo, right? The audience would probably get the use of the word dish to mean, like, oh, you're an attractive person. Like, all the dishes are dirty. Like, oh, speak for yourself. You know?
So, wait, dish means?
Like, an attractive. You know, like, well, isn't he just a dish? You know? Like, it's the
I
same.
I would not have been cool in the 1960s.
Well, it's the same sort of thing. You know, nowadays we describe someone as the full damn meal, right? Or a snack.
Maybe, okay, there we go. Now you've caught me up.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know,
so,
like,
okay,
oh,
yeah.
He's a snack, right? It's the same thing, right? But back then it was, he's a dish.
A dish. Okay.
Yeah.
So the dishes are dirty would mean that all the attractive people are ugly?
Yeah. All the dishes are dirty would just be like, oh,
yeah. All the attractive people are dirty.
Yeah, exactly.
But dirty
and then,
second way.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. At which point Sandy, oh, well, speak for yourself, right? Yeah, because he's attractive.
I would be so lost.
Exactly.
Thank you for handholding my way through gays.
I got you.
I don't even think I'm cool, but I'm not.
But here's the fun thing. Well-versed Polari speakers would also know that the word dish means anus. So
work here, everyone's ass is dirty.
Yeah,
gay,
I thought ass.
Yeah.
I thought I was keeping up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm apparently as lost as you are, actually.
Yeah.
I thought I was doing good.
Yeah.
Oh my
yeah,
god.
Yeah, no.
Two
so
men in here were just doing our best.
Yeah, it's fine. You guys are fine.
We're trying.
You know, it's fine. It's fine. You got one non-binary weird mm-hmm. history buff speaking with two more or less straight men. But yeah, so one of the reasons that this wound up working really, really well was mm-hmm. that they wound up being these two, you know, mm-hmm. Julie and Sandy, these two characters, wound up being delightfully subversive.
Mm-hmm.
And because they were able to utilize this in a way that would get past the BBC censors as well, it really helped to bring queerness, and specifically the kind of domestic queerness that these two characters had, a little bit more into the limelight.
Yes.
And because, again, nobody would have thought, like, this is a dirty show. It was acceptable to listen to it with your family. You know?
And so you can portray gay people in a way that isn't making them sexual deviants.
Exactly.
It's just like, look, these are just normal people that happen to like each other.
And that said, the people who spoke Polari would be like, oh my god, these two are sexual deviants.
but we love them.
Yeah, exactly, right? So what winds up happening in 1967, it's the same year that Round the Horn is at its peak and it wins the award for Best Comedy Radio Program. But the legal situation for the average gay man was improved, where like 10 years earlier that there had been like a recommendation that had been like, hey, I think we should lift a lot of these, you know, restrictions and all these sorts of things. And finally, some of those things start to get implemented. So these dear, sweet 1960s and, you know, now 70s gays are finding themselves increasingly able to, you know, more show their appreciation and their love for each other. It's still much easier to, you know, kind of poke a little bit,
mm-hmm.
But Polari starts to fall out of vogue a little bit, because as it gets safer, there's less need for the language to be used by these outskirts of society.
Yeah, it becomes a relic, so people don't need to use it to keep themselves safe anymore.
Precisely. So, like, by the 1980s, it had pretty much, like, vanished from the UK gay scene.
Okay.
Like, by that point in time, it was basically like, yeah, if you're gay,
you can just be, just, you can just wear some clothing.
Pretty much.
Or like,
I mean,
the earring thing starts to come in.
Well, absolutely, because like there were, instead of like Polari speakers, you would have like the American influence. So like Butch was a look. That would be like,
people start dressing.
Yeah, start dressing, more visual coding, being mm-hmm. like, hey, yeah, you can tell that is a gay man because he is dressed in leather and has a mustache like that.
I forgot the Freddie Mercury look
right?
was a statement. Ah, that's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, of course, like, as the 90s progressed, it wound up kind of, like, experiencing, like, a small revival.
Mm-hmm.
But specifically in more of, like a reverential kind of way. Like, it wound up being kind of fun, where there's a group in London known as the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
They sound cool.
Yeah, no, they're a bunch of gays. But they use High Polari in their blessings.
Oh, High Polari.
Yeah, exactly.
I gotcha. It becomes like the Latin of their prayers.
Exactly.
That's very fun.
Precisely. So it winds up being really, really fun. It still does kind of have a like a controversial position still. Just because there was a lot of, you know, we're going to pick this word from, like, Romani. We're going to pick this word from Hebrew. We're going to pick this word from, like, so it does kind of still have some interesting, like, connotations to it. But at the same time, the roots of it have always wound up being these people have been the ones who have been made to live on the outskirts.
Yeah.
And now we're kind of bringing those words into the light of day.
Okay, fantastic.
Which is
kind
of fun.
That's really, really cool. So,
yeah.
Do people use it at all anymore, or is it just, it's kind of a footnoting
you know,
history?
Along that line, there are a lot of words that we still use.
That are from Polari.
So, if you were to say something and I replied with, oh, I've got your number, right? That means I understand where you're coming from. I know what you are. I know what you're saying, right?
All right.
That was a very common phrase.
Okay.
So there are a lot. One of my other personal favorites is, this is a much more specific, like, British one.
Mm-hmm.
But have you ever heard, if you watch a British television show, have you ever heard someone describe something as naff?
Naff, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that means bad or, yeah, like, trashy.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah.
There are several, that was a very popular word in Polari. There are several, theories as to what it originally came from and what it originally stood for. One of the most prominent ones, sorry for the horrible British accent, but, you know, well, he's a bit naff, ain't he? Right?
Yeah. He's kind of shitty. He looks kind of gross.
Right? If that were two gay men speaking,
mm-hmm.
Naff, N-A-F-F, is not available for fucking. It was basically a way for them to be
naff,
like,
he's tired.
He's naff. He's tired and he's straight.
Phone.
Well, it would either be like he's tired or he's straight.
Oh, he's straight.
Like, look
oh,
at
okay.
him. He's straight.
I
like,
gotcha. Oh, that guy's naff. That
yeah.
guy's naff. Don't worry about him. He's not available.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool.
He's not available for. He's
That's
not,
very cool.
Yeah. So some of these words have continued into the modern vernacular
yeah.
in ways that we never would have expected. And I just find that's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool to see how, like, counterculture, and I guess I would definitely classify this as counterculture, although many more people are gay than you would imagine.
Yeah.
Like, especially at this time, most people are just repressed. But it's crazy how many things from, like, countercultures get mixed into actual culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
absolutely.
It's kind of common knowledge that, like, Elvis was so popular because he was just doing what black artists were already doing.
Yep.
But because
but he
was white, it was accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And so people could admit that they liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he becomes, like, the father of rock music. When in truly...
He's just singing
black music, but he's making it accessible.
For a white audience.
For white audiences,
who,
they're allowed to like it.
Yeah.
Which is just, it's incredible how much culture seeps in, even when you try very hard to keep it out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very, very cool. In a very cool way. So you can't reject things, because those things will always seep in, because you won't even notice them.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Exactly.
Very, very
so,
cool.
So that's a moderate little lecture there on the history of Polari.
I like lectures.
And I really, it's a... personally a very fascinating topic to me, because I myself am queer, and it's really interesting to see the overarching,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, hey, this is what my forefathers had to do
yeah, absolutely.
To do this, and now, if I wanted to, I could just hop on Tinder and be like, I'm interested in you.
Men, women... sock puppets.
All of the above.
Yes.
Yes to
yes.
the sock
yeah.
puppets.
Yeah. No. Is
no. Just yes in general.
Yeah. No.
Yes in general.
What are your preferences?
Yes.
Yes.
That is really cool. That is really, really cool. Gay history is especially very interesting, because it's always the history of, like, subterfuge
yep.
and, like, oppression and fights. If this is a blue episode, I'd love to do an episode on why Nancy Reagan, like, how many men with AIDS Nancy Reagan killed.
Yeah.
Like,
oh my God.
Nancy Reagan is personally responsible for the deaths of so many men with AIDS, and she's terrible. And
yeah.
she did a really bad thing. And also, Ronald Reagan is terrible.
Yes.
But Nancy Reagan in particular
was terrible.
Was
yeah.
bad.
Yeah,
but...
Oh, God. I apologize.
No, that was great.
Talking about, like, other, you know, figures or whatever,
mm-hmm.
One of the other, like, it was half Polari and then half gay slang as
mm-hmm.
things, you know, went in. Friends of Dorothy.
Friends of Dorothy. Dorothy Day?
No. So, I don't know if you guys know this or not. Judy Garland
mm-hmm.
was a huge advocate for the queer community.
Awesome.
Yeah. So,
didn't know that, but that's great.
Yeah, right? So if someone was described as being a friend of Dorothy, because Judy Garland played Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz,
yes.
it was a way of saying, like, oh, that's a gay person.
They're chill.
Yes.
They're chill.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I do love that, actually.
Yeah.
That is very cool. Yes.
So, yeah, there you go. Little
awesome.
Little bit of secret language. Now, you've got spies.
No, secret language actually ties in really well to this. Because we're also gonna be in Britain, but also in the Americas for a little bit, because we're gonna be talking about the Irregulars.
Okay.
So during World War II, there was a British spy ring in the United States. Now, because most people, when they think of World War II, so you guys are aware that the United States did not enter. Everybody knows this. The United States did not enter World War II until the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So there was a good section of the war. The United States entered the war about 2 years after it started. The war started officially in 1939 when Hitler attacked, where Hitler invaded his first country, I believe. Oh, gosh, I'm not going to say it because I'm going to be wrong. But he invaded his first country. He invaded Poland. Great. Thank you, Kit, for mouthing it to me. You emasculated again on my own show. It's fine.
This is a daily occurrence for me.
I'm sorry.
But he'd been making aggressive moves for quite a while. So at the time, Britain had a Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, who had made this policy of kind of appeasement. It was like, he's very powerful. We don't really want to get involved in a war if we can, because the horrors of World War I were still fresh on everyone's mind. And it was called the Great War.
Yeah.
Little did they know. the sequel was coming. So Hitler was making all these aggressive moves, and America is staunchly isolationist at this point. They want nothing to do with any war in Europe. They don't want to send their men to die. They had supported England in the First World War, and England still owed America a bunch of war debt, like, that just hadn't been paid. A lot of American soldiers had died. And at the time, a lot of people love to think that, like, we were very anti-Nazi because we're American as apple pie and Nazis are bad. Nazis are bad. There were a lot of pro-Nazi, pro-isolationist congressmen and congresspeople at the time in the United States who were either very, like, we don't have anything to do with a war in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
If Hitler wants to take all of Europe and North Africa, there's a whole ocean between us. There's no reason for us to get involved. And there were also a lot of people who were like, this Hitler seems like a fine fella to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Texas, and I love two things, barbecue and swastikas. I think they're fine. They were American Nazi parties.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's this huge amount of anti-war fervor in the United States. And until Japan kind of formally invites us by attacking Pearl Harbor, there were many who believed that, you know, the United States would never enter the war.
Yeah.
So enter the Irregulars. The Irregulars is a British spy ring, and it's made up of some people that you might already know. There's William Stevenson, Ian Fleming, who is the man who wrote James Bond.
Yeah.
Also cousins with Christopher Lee. Who is it?
Count Dooku?
The guy who played Count Dooku.
I don't know his name, but he's very cool. Christopher, no.
Was it Christopher Lee?
Maybe Christopher Lee? Yeah, maybe it was Christopher Lee.
I think it was Christopher Lee.
You Google that.
I do that right now.
James Bond was actually based on the activities of the Irregulars.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, so it was Christopher Lee?
Yeah, it was Christopher
Lee.
Fantastic.
Okay, so Ian Fleming is cousins with Christopher Lee.
He based the James Bond books off of Christopher Lee.
So William Stevenson, Ian Fleming, Noel Coward, the playwright,
mm-hmm.
David Ogilvy, who becomes this magazine magnate, Leslie Howard, and Roald Dahl.
The guy who wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
The BFG, Matilda, the Twits, the Twitches, all of those books. Spy.
Incredible!
And not only a spy, this is a blue episode, not only is he a spy, he is one of the sexy spies.
He's a sexy spy.
This man lays pipe for his country.
I'm so excited right
so
now.
So we're gonna kind of Roald Dahl is gonna be kind of our point of view character here. So Roald Dahl is part of the Irregulars, but he's not yet part of the Irregulars. So Roald Dahl is a RAF pilot in World War One.
Okay,
World War II. He's an RAF pilot.
Mm-hmm.
He is fighting, and he's using these outdated aircraft. He's fighting in Libya. He doesn't get shot down, but he gets separated from his unit. He watches his entire unit get destroyed. He watches them all die in their cockpits, get burned or crash into the ground and die. He himself crashes in the desert, hits and his nose just implodes into his own face. He gets dragged out of the wreck. He drags himself out of the wreckage, gets found by a rescue team, and has like 9 different plastic surgeries to repair his face.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad they did, because he needed it for later. But...
because he was going to be a sexy spy.
Yeah, well, a lot of people know that Roald Dahl, he wrote some adult fiction as well. It was
mm-hmm.
very, very dark.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff, like, do you ever read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory 2, The Great Glass Elevator?
Yeah, that was one of my favorites.
It's very fun. There are aliens in it that just murder people.
Yep.
There's a whole chapter, like, the second chapter of the book, just a bunch of people in a space hotel get wrecked.
Yep.
So he's got a lot of this dark thoughts in him. So he gets pulled, he gets all this reconstruction done, he gets pulled back in, and he starts teaching people how to fly these planes, but he has these blackout headaches that are so bad that he cannot fly. He'll black out in the air. And so he gets attached as an American air attaché to the American embassy in Britain. Excuse me, the British embassy in America.
Mm-hmm.
So his job is basically to go over and, like, shake hands, kiss babies. He was very hot. The lady who wrote the book that I'm basing a lot of this off of, she gave a talk. She called him hot, like, 5 times. I looked up a picture. He's okay. At least in my, as a cis white male, I don't know. He wasn't that hot. You gotta Google what Roald Dahl looked like. But he's this big, tall, lanky guy, and he's wearing his, like, RAF uniform. So he mostly just goes around, and he gets, so before and during the war, America is entirely separated from this conflict. Like, the Blitz isn't happening in the United States. Everything is quite nice. Like, the boys are being sent off, but, like, you know, there's a lot of cocktail parties. A lot of the money of Washington, D.C., is being sent.
Was hot. The jawline.
Yeah, no. I'm
sorry.
There's also, like, the melancholic, like, sadness in his eyes. Yeah, exactly. No, like, I could. I can just see, like, all of these, you know, women in the 40s just like, oh my god, I could fix him. He's clearly traumatized.
Well, American women absolutely thought so.
Yeah.
Because they loved Roald Dahl. So he writes.
And he has
this
a sexy British accent.
He does, I guess. I don't find British accents particularly sexy. I find like high RP British sexy, low RP British, I find very turn offish. But
they can speak however they want.
So he is an American air attaché. His job is truly, he goes around, he gives speeches, he goes, you know, the British are fighting very hard to defend their country from Hitler. I watched a bunch of my friends die. Let me tell you the story of how I crashed my plane into a desert in Libya and then crawled out and saved my own life. And so he tells this story a bunch of times, and a propagandist comes to him and says, hey man, I'd love to, like, write up a piece. And Roald Dahl goes, I've already written it.
Roald Dahl
hasn't written anything yet. So he writes this piece, and he goes, and it's called, the guy, propagandist changed it to, like, Shot Down Over Libya.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Roald Dahl had originally entitled it A Piece of Cake. And so they changed the name, and it gets him very famous. So people are asking him to come write speeches, and they're coming asking him to come and do performances there. But he's getting this fame, but he's not really, he doesn't enjoy his job. He hates how blasé everyone is. Because, like, all these old money people who usually go and, like, vacation in Europe and go to the Alps and all these different places and go to ski resorts, they can't go anywhere because the war is on. You can go visit Canada, I guess. That's pretty much it. So all these highfalutin society people are stuck in Washington. And so they start throwing these big extravagant parties to entertain themselves. And he is a foreigner in a sexy uniform with his sexy accent. And he's super tall. And he becomes a fixture at these parties. And so William Stevenson, codename Intrepid, is a large part of a branch of warfare called the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, directly under William Churchill. Winston Churchill.
I love that name.
It's a great name.
Also, that doesn't surprise me that Winston Churchill was in charge of that.
Mm-hmm.
God, I love Winston Churchill. Yeah.
So William Stevenson, codename Intrepid, gets Roald Dahl fired. Comes and says, Roald Dahl, I'd love to have you more involved in a way that you can actually help. And Roald Dahl goes, I am so sick of attending dinner parties and doing nothing for my country. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I'm down. And so Stevenson goes, great, you're fired. Fires him, then immediately sends him to the British embassy over in Britain, sends him to the embassy back in Britain, and then rehires him as a member of this new squad, the Irregulars. So Roald Dahl comes back over as ostensibly the same job. He's officially dismissed for misconduct. One of the quotes from William Stevenson was, Roald Dahl was not very well-behaved. He was well-known for his sexual conquests. This is a very spicy story. And William Stevenson said, one of the reasons I chose him because no one would believe someone that badly behaved could be a spy. So he basically comes back. He comes back and he continues doing exactly what he was doing before, but now he has a purpose. He's trying to get into the higher echelons of American society, because mm-hmm. now as part of the Irregulars, he learns what their mission is. It's very simple and very broad. Find as many isolationist members of American Congress and American political spheres of influence. Find people who are anti-Roosevelt, because FDR was a noted supporter of the war and supporter of Europe, and convince them however you need to. Mm-hmm. Right? Also gather American information, because we're trying to learn as much about American, because when the war ends, America will be the dominant superpower. It's very clear that America will be in charge of this of the world when the war is over. So he comes back, he starts doing things. He also starts writing stories. He writes his first little children's story called The Gremlins, which is about these little monsters that live in RAF planes and sabotage them and cause them to crash. It's so well received that Walt Disney comes, flies him out to Burbank and says, I'd like to buy the rights to The Gremlins, buys it. Eleanor Roosevelt herself loves reading it to her children so much, she invites Roald Dahl to the White House. And Roald Dahl becomes a fixture at the White House.
That is incredible.
So he becomes a spy on FDR and prominent women.
Yeah.
Dahl reportedly have affairs with oil heiress Millicent Rogers, French actress Annabella, and Congresswoman Claire Booth Luce, who was the wife of the owner of Time and Life magazine. So she is a congresswoman. She's also married to an isolationist who owns Time magazine and Life magazine. Yes.
I mean, if she was sleeping with Roald Dahl while she was married, you could say she was a loose woman.
She was known that in the press. They had reportedly what was considered an open marriage.
Okay.
More open. I mean, as open as you could be. He apparently spent a lot of time away at a different home, and Roald Dahl was not the first person she had taken into bed as a congresswoman.
Specifically with the last name, that's kind of funny.
Yeah. Dahl's mission was to persuade Luce to become more pro-British in her political leanings. This is a quote from him. I hoped to be able to make her change her views a little and say something better next time that she speaks. He told his mother that.
He was in... Mom, I'm a spy. I'm a spy. A lot of women to be a spy.
Just imagine those phone calls home, you know. Oh, hi, honey. How's everything going? How are your travels? Great, Mom.
I'm sleeping with America.
I have been fucking my way all the way up the East Coast.
I want you to know, this man suffered. We'll get to it. This man suffered for his country. So one of the best things that the Irregulars did, not just Roald Dahl, because Roald Dahl becomes what you would call a buffer between Winston Churchill and FDR. So he would go and hang out with FDR, and whenever they were alone together, FDR would go, I wonder what Winston, mm-hmm. would think about this, and would just say some stuff.
Yeah.
And then Roald Dahl would be like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I guess I'll see. And then next week he would come back and visit FDR and be like, I think Winnie would think this about that. And FDR was completely aware that Roald Dahl was an English spy.
Oh, absolutely.
But FDR was quite pro-Britain at this time. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Irregulars did was they got a fake map that they had created onto the desk of FDR. They got all the way through American intelligence. And this map depicted what South America would look like after Hitler had invaded and carved it all up and distributed it to South American countries. And it showed all these tanks, on the border of Mexico, pointed into the United States. Mm. Showing that Hitler was planning a full invasion as soon as he could. Now, Hitler obviously had designs on the whole world at some point.
Sure, yeah.
This map, entirely fake. They had just made it up. FDR goes before Congress seven or eight times, and it's just shaking this map in the air. We have to go to war. We have to send more money. We have to send more troops. But the Irregulars are, kind of spreading this information. So Roald Dahl is now working on Claire Luth Boose. She is 13 years his senior, and he has been told, if with the right kind of encouragement, to try and warm her to the British position. The very tall and athletic Dahl claimed he found his affair with Claire to be so physically demanding that he had begged the British ambassador to relieve him of his task. She's 13 years older than him. She bought a hotel room for 3 days, took him to the hotel, and they did not leave for 3 days. He has a quote he sent back in a letter he wrote. This goddamn woman has screwed me up and down this room for 3 days. I don't think I can do this anymore. I want out. Like, I need to come back. I need to take a breath. And the ambassador told him, close your eyes and think of England.
Dude,
do it for your country.
I was going to make a joke about chafing earlier when you said that he suffered. Not thinking that was actually going to be the case.
Dear Lord.
I don't know. I mean, just...
Oh, my Lord.
This woman had stamina.
She apparently very, very much did. Absolutely, she very much did. So...
Holy.
Insatiable.
Absolutely. So all throughout the war this happens. Roald Dahl is this spy. He's playing pipe for England. And Ian Fleming, Noel Coward, all these different, various people in the arts and the humanities are convincing pro-isolationist people to change their position or writing, pro-Britain propaganda, stuff like that. So, this is kind of where we get to, like, towards the end of the war. So, everyone can see, like, I mean, of course, the end of the war was a terrible time. The Germans were fighting with everything they had. Hitler was making really bad decisions. We talked about this in the Farting Führer episode. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to listen to that yet, listeners. But if you haven't, we learn a little bit why Hitler was so erratic towards the end of the war. It's because he was absolutely zonked out of his mind on morphine and cocaine.
Yep.
And also his anti-fart pills. So definitely check that episode out. It's crazy. But it's still a bad time. People are dying. People are bleeding and fighting in the war. But in the spy circles... people are kind of wrapping up operations,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, it's just a land war left, right? Berlin is surrounded. And now American intelligence, which has basically grown during the World War II, there wasn't an American intelligence organization before then. There was a Secret Service, but they weren't doing, foreign operations. They were relying entirely on British intelligence, Canadian intelligence, other people to give them their things. And so... all these American intelligence agents who have never really existed before, the CIA doesn't even exist yet, it's something called the OSS, it realizes that there are dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of British spies in the United States.
Mm.
Roald Dahl being one of them, Ian Fleming, William Stevenson, codename Intrepid. It's just a cool codename, I like to say
it. It's a really cool codename.
It's a cool codename. And so as soon as the war ends... they realize that they're going to have to expel all of these spies because, these spies are going to continue to try and influence American politics. For instance, one of the other things that Roald Dahl did was during these dinner parties he would go to, he got his hands on a document from Pan Am talking about air bases that were going to be built all over Europe. And realizing, he read this and realized that Pan Am had basically locked in the rights to dominate air travel internationally. Like, I don't know if you're aware of this. It's covered a little bit in the movie, like, Catch Me If You Can. But Pan Am was the airline for a while. International, domestic, it was it.
Mm-hmm.
Pan Am was it.
It was pretty much a monopoly.
It was pretty much a monopoly, right? And it was an airline travel at the time was how the rich, the wealthy, the personal and popular, it's how they got anywhere. So it's a huge threat to the decline of the British Empire, which also England realizes is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Right, they've been devastated by this war. They've thrown everything they've had into defeating Hitler, and who's going to come out more, stronger on the other side? It's America, who are snapping up Nazi scientists left and right,
mm-hmm.
working on their moon program. So Roald Dahl starts reporting back to Churchill on the moon program that is being worked on. It's still in its infant stages, but the moon program is being worked on. Starts talking about how Soviet Russia and the Cold War is going to be starting. He gets his hand on this document. He locks himself in the bathroom at this party with this Pan Am document and then calls someone and says, I need you to come to this address, come to this party. He, drops this document out the bathroom window. This guy takes it back to the British Embassy, copies the whole thing, brings it back to Roald Dahl, who is still in the bathroom, and then, folds it up into, a tube and, hucks it up at this window. Roald Dahl catches it, comes out of the bathroom, puts it back.
Incredible.
Yeah, so he's doing real spy work. It's not just this very, camaraderie, hey, I know you're a spy, I'm telling you stuff I need the other guy to know.
Mm-hmm.
Because Winston Churchill and FDR didn't really like to communicate through State Department, so there's too many eyes on all that information.
Yeah, whereas having just this one guy who's a trusted in-between.
Who's a trusted in-between. Mm-hmm. But after the war ends, all of these spies are just immediately, we need you to leave now. If you leave now, there will be no problems. If you don't leave, we're going to start charging you for, you know, treason. FDR could have been impeached if people knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
If congressional investigations had happened, they're like, okay, so how did all this information actually get to you?
Yeah.
Right? You were talking to a British spy? Or there were British spies in your house? Like, that's unacceptable to us. And so the OSS gets all these people removed, and they start scrubbing this. So a lot of what we know about the irregulars is actually quite, like, there's so many more operations that they did that we don't know about, because the OSS and because British Secret Service, MI6 and MI5, scrubbed it all. Because if any record of this had come out during the Cold War, it could have soured relationships between the new superpower of the United States and the older power, the declined empire of the British Empire. And they needed that to be a wall against the Soviets, who are now engaged in a Cold War with the United States. So it's so cool to me that one of the most prolific children's authors laid pipe across the United States for his country and then was like, and I guess I'll just never talk about it.
Yep.
I guess I'll just go write
a story about chocolate. Yeah, I'm just going to write some more children's books.
Write some more children's stories. But it's really cool. I highly recommend looking it up. There's some great books about it. But it's just, it's a very, very cool thing that all these spies basically were just like, all right, and we're going to melt away. And
that's so cool. That's so cool and so crazy. Like mm-hmm. just the amount of work that they must have put in, you know, transmitting all of this information back to Britain, only to then just vanish as if they'd never been there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
World War II was such a wild time for just military operations in general, like mm-hmm. back and forth. Like that's when we get the first assault rifle. That's when we get the first jet engine fighter. That's when we get, like, that's when...
First atomic bomb was invented.
The first atomic bomb. That's when, like, that's when aircraft carriers became the new predominant naval force. That's when, like,
mm-hmm.
the intelligence services did, like, the intelligence services, like you said, had to, like, learn so quickly and upgrade so fast.
The learning curve was steep, and they kept up.
Another topic for another time, if you don't know about them, is, like, the Navajo...
Code talkers. Those are great. Like, those are very, very cool.
Oh my god, everything about World War II is just like, we're just gonna like supercharge militaries across the world because
I just want you to know, as two straight white men, we run a very high risk of like going very deep into World War II as we get older and older.
Oh, yeah.
And eventually you and I are gonna be sitting on a couch together smoking cigars and watching Bridge Over the River Kwai talking about how cool General Patton was. And when we get there, we need to stop. Yeah.
I already don't necessarily like General Patton a whole lot. Now, if we're talking about Mad Jack Churchill, I'll talk about him all day.
You ever heard of Bazooka Charlie?
I have heard of Bazooka Charlie. I don't remember the full story.
Well, I did an episode on him, last week. But Bazooka Charlie's really cool. He was this guy who strapped bazookas onto his plane because he was sick of flying spotter planes over tanks who didn't even shoot back at him. And he would dive bomb tanks and just shoot them with bazookas, and then he would go refuel. Can you imagine like taking out an army 6 bazookas at a time? All right, I gotta go land. He's just a madman. One of the other cool things I learned about the vice president at the time, his last name was Wallace, was very pro-communist. He was quiet about it during the war, but afterwards he ran on a pro-communist thing. And the irregulars were very heavily involved in keeping him away from FDR as much as possible and, like, spying on him because they understood that communism, once the World War II ended, communism would be the next big threat that the empires of the United States and the British would have to face. So they also, they took him down, basically. They exposed him as a communist. They ruined his political career. But also during World War II, something called the limpet mine was invented. You know what a limpet mine is?
I hate the name.
It's in my head, and I can't...
It's an underwater mine that you can use, and it's timed. The guy who invented it used something called aniseed balls, which are a candy that melted in salt water at an exact rate. So he would just he would melt down these aniseed balls and coat C4 in it, and then he would put a shaped charge with this C4 that was covered in aniseed balls on it, He would stick it on there, and then he would swim. You could, like, send one diver in, stick it on, swim away. Mm-hmm. And then the salt water would melt the aniseed until, like, maybe 15 to 20 minutes later, it would fully dissolve, and then it would explode.
Yep.
As soon as the C4 made contact with the salt water, or yep. I don't know exactly what the trigger was, but so, the aniseed would keep the firing pin away from it.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. I think that's what the frogmen used, like the original mm-hmm. Navy SEALs Limpet. Used was those. And how that works is, I think it probably separated it from like an electrical charge, or like mm-hmm. when the salt water hit it, it would create an electrical charge, and then C4 would detonate.
Absolutely.
Or whatever the explosive. Too, yeah, so. Or whatever the explosive was, because I don't think it was C4. I don't think C4 was developed just. Yeah, I might be wrong
they
about
were,
that.
They were using C4. They were using C4 in World War II because some of the guerrillas that were training in the Canadian SAS training facilities, the guerrilla fighters would use C4 to catch fish.
Yep.
They would make little C4 bombs. They would drop them into canals, and they would explode, and then the fish would float to the surface, and they'd be like, dinner time. It's dinner time in Canada.
Like, that was another thing, too. It's like, Navy SEALs were born in World War II. Like, oh, God, it's wild.
It's wild.
I think I just need to see. I'll sit back, but I want to see you both, and then Mikkel and
Raffi
just all sitting here.
Just talking about World War II.
Talking World War II.
World War II and weird
my
military.
My buddy Raffi, he's been on the show a bunch of times. He knows so much about military history. We play a Dungeons & Dragons campaign mm-hmm. where he is an automaton from Prussia. And occasionally, he's an automaton from Prussia. And occasionally I'll be like, okay, and then in your backstory, you know, you were over in Austria. And he's like, Austria is nowhere near Prussia. And I was like, what? And he like pulls up a map and he goes, no. So you see the border is right here. I'm like, you're 16, my dude. Why do you care? He's like, it's what I care about. I'm like, okay. Fair. All right. I guess that's fair.
There you go.
Well, thank you so much for listening, dear viewers. Thank you guys both for being on another great episode. It's fantastic to have y'all back. Kit, you did a fantastic job. Thank you for telling me how the cool gays talked.
Yeah, well, you did a fantastic job as well. Thank you for telling me about how sexy Roald Dahl was.
Roald Dahl, very sexy. The BFG, big fucking... I don't know. Will, thanks for coming.
Yeah! It was fun being here. This was a fun episode.
Oh, all right, incredible. Well, if you enjoyed the episode, ladies and gentlemen, you're welcome to go ahead and follow or be subscribed to us on Spotify. You can follow our Facebook page and wait for the next episode to come out. But thank you so much for coming and listening to us. I hope you enjoyed yourself. And if you didn't, well, I tried. Goodbye!